It's the official, unofficial podcast of the city of Trenton, New Jersey. Yeah. With your host, Frank Ferocious Sasso.
Trenton still makes and the world still takes.
And Christina Firestarter Sasso.
Trenton is Mayberry with attitude.
Hang tight, because we're going to meet the lifeblood behind the culture, food, arts, music, pork roll, punk rock, hair, butts,
education, talent, events,
of Trenton, New Jersey. Here's Frank and Christina.
And now my phone is ringing. You know what's funny is that I don't have the ringer on. So like last time when Bill Kearney was here, like the whispering. It's just, we're trying to display a certain amount of professionalism. You don't stop whispering to each other, guests. We have two guests here today. So we're fresh back from Dallas, Texas. We were at the podcast movement. Yeah, I wasn't crazy about Dallas.
This is what I don't like about conferences. Like, you're stuck in a hotel.
Yeah.
And then you get out a little bit, maybe to go to dinner or something. And,
right.
And you really don't get to see Dallas. I mean, it seemed more like a business district than a fun town. But there was that cute little fun area where we went when we had Kenny Black's barbecue, wasn't
Terry
it?
Terry Black's barbecue. Who's Kenny?
I don't know. Terry Black's barbecue.
Right.
Shout out to Terry Black.
Yeah.
Phenomenal pork ribs. Being inexperienced, right. They were selling the ribs by the pound, and I'm like, right. Oh, okay. I'm usually buying them by the rack. So I said, I'm not going to buy a rack of ribs because it's going to be like $100. So let me get four ribs. Big mistake. I could only eat two. That's how big these ribs were.
And they were also like $30 a pound.
Yes.
I'm like,
yes.
And I saw the size of them at first. I'm like, I don't know about this.
We should have been watching the guy in front of us because he was doing it the right way.
He
he bought one rib. Mm-hmm. He bought one beef rib.
Yeah.
Then he bought brisket. And then he got the turkey sausage. So he got to try all the different things.
When I saw what he was doing, I'm like, look at this guy. Is this guy for real? Yeah, one rib? But you're right. And the mac and cheese was great too. And the string beans.
I know, everything was very, very good.
String beans were great.
Very good.
All right, so Podcastia, we just want to say hello first. Hello, Podcastia.
Hello.
We have two women with us today. Podcastia, pray for me because I'm in the room with three women. Mm-hmm. And these women are historians and they're already banging their stuff on the table. They just don't care. They don't give a crap. They really don't. If it's their show, oh, forget about it. But if it's our show, we're guests.
Whatever.
Screw you. Hey, excuse me. Excuse me. Hush. Until I introduce you. All
Please,
right.
You know where that's going to go.
Listen, I'm not stopping. All I'm not editing. I'm not doing nothing.
Go ahead.
We have, first of all, they're authors.
Yes.
They wrote the book, If These Stones Could Talk. And it's about rock collecting is what that book is about.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic. It's a truly compelling book. And it's a great read. One of these women, Beverly Mills, is also related to one of our podcasters, James Peoples. And my condolences, Beverly. Hello, James. How you doing, buddy? They have a show on the New Pod City Podcast Network called Lifting the Veil. And you were just on one of their episodes, weren't you, Beb?
Yes, I was.
How was that? Was it fun?
It was amazing. And we didn't want to stop talking.
Yeah. Well, you get these women talking, man. They can go. They can just go off on any topic you throw at them. They don't care. So joining us right now, today, from Lifting the Veil and If These Stones Could Talk, we're here with Beverly Mills and Lady Elaine Buck is here with us. Very, very cool. Oh, see, they love you. Studio audience. Okay, podcast here. Calm down. There you go. Okay. Hello, ladies.
Hello.
Hello.
Fabulous to be here.
Okay, so we have an intense conversation ahead of us.
Okay.
We're going to talk about all things black. How's that?
Thank you.
It's about time.
See? It is about time. And you no one talks about the black situation. Not quite like you guys anyway.
Not like us.
No, no. What brings you to Trenton?
Well, I'm very familiar with Trenton. My grandmother bought a house here back in 1947. She was one of the first black women to have a beauty shop, and she was a businesswoman.
Wow.
And she was an entrepreneur. So I grew up knowing about Trenton. Mm-hmm. Trenton was a thriving place for blacks to live. Awesome. I remember going down Spring Street where my aunt and uncle lived, and Spring Street was one of the most beautiful streets you'd ever see in Trenton. Yeah.
Mm. I was just going to say, I've been on Spring Street, and I can honestly say I think it's a beautiful street. Yes. I mean, it has so much potential. It's a beautiful street.
It was so lovely, and I remember you could just walk up and down the streets very freely, and many of the black professionals lived on Spring Street. I remember a couple doctors lived down the street, down on the block further. There were a couple lawyers. There was a mortician, many school teachers, educators. It's kind of like one of the pockets where the black middle to upper class community lived.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with Trenton. And Elaine, you actually lived here.
Yes, my husband, John, we bought a HUD home on Bellevue Avenue, and it was right near Calhoun Street, right near the Shiloh Baptist Church. Kind of stuck out like a sore thumb because we both grew up in Hopewell. But we fit right in. I loved my beautiful 5-bedroom home. What really surprised us, because now, you know, it's in the 80s, the late 70s, early 80s, was how the community was sort of the same as the community that we just came from, living in Hopewell with all blacks. So here we are, we're on Bellevue Avenue. It was a little community there. We were in the 200 block. We lived there long enough to make connections with all the people. Some of them were homeowners and some of them were renters.
Mm-hmm.
But it was wonderful living among my own people, because living in Hopewell, there wasn't a lot of black people around. So
we had our section.
Yes, we just had
We were relegated to a section.
A section, and I was related to most of these, most of the people that lived on Columbia Avenue in Hopewell. Living on Bellevue Avenue was an experience for us, but it also was an experience for our neighbors, too.
Yeah.
We decided that we wanted to beautify the neighborhood because we kept hearing how beautiful Bellevue Avenue was.
Right.
And so we beautified the neighborhood. We had a 200-block association, and we had a contest to see who could beautify their home. When we got grass and we, you know, grass seed, and we got plants. We went to Rosedale Mills in Pennington, which I'll send a plug out to them. And we got all the things that we needed to beautify the neighborhood. And then we had a contest. But one thing we did was we made the children were involved in the beautification too. They helped us plant and they helped us grow. We all dug together, started digging up the yards and putting down the grass seed. And then I went and got them all whistles. And anybody that dropped litter on any part of 200 block, they were to blow the whistle and tell them no litter. And we had trash cans. We put trash cans out there. So it was...
Did that work?
It did, but it took some work because, you know, people were just naturally used to just dropping.
And they'd blow
litter.
The whistle and then say no litter?
Oh, yeah. The kids
and the person
blew
would come back
whistle.
And want to throw it away?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
they would?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, so it worked.
Yeah. And then we had to keep people from walking on the grass because, you know, it was like baby grass.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, the mailman would kind of walk from one yard to the next. He was just kind of used to doing that.
Right.
And then we had to break him up from doing that. So it was wonderful working together. And I enjoyed living in Trenton. But the thing that people laugh at us about is our house was kind of the crazy house, of course, because with 5 bedrooms, it was just my husband and I, and then we had our son. So we would rent the rooms out to different people. And so the people that were walking by would look at our house. I heard one of them when I was sitting on the porch say, "Watch out for them, they crazy." And then it didn't help that my husband was one of the few, I want to say he was one of two black blasters. He was a demolitions expert and
what's a blaster?
Yeah, he worked for McAlinden Construction Company and the explosive company.
Right.
And he would bring the dynamite truck and park it in front of our house.
Oh, that must have caused.
Oh, fantastic.
And keep in mind, we were only in our 20s. So our house was sort of a party house, but we also had the dynamite truck.
So you had a dynamite truck parked in front of your house. What type of people were you renting to? Blacks, whites?
That's a good question, because growing up in Hopewell, almost all of our friends were white.
So right, that's why I'm asking.
Yep, we had Henry, who was white. And then we had Johnny's cousin who came to the Halloween party that we had and never moved out. So we had him. And then
stayed in costume the whole time?
Yes.
And then you can see why people might think
that. No, because you have black people coming out, white people coming out, you got a costume coming out, you got a dynamite truck in front of the house. I can definitely understand why people would think it was like a crazy spot.
And so, I mean, and then we had like our neighbor next door was, we had two elderly people. They were older than us. And they kind of got to like us too. At first, they were like, "Oh my God, what is this?" But it was, and we lived the same way we lived in Hopewell. I always have my door open. I like fresh air, so I had the front door was always open, and I heard another person going by saying, "They have their door open like that," and that's when the other person said, "They crazy."
Yeah, well, that is strange. Especially during the summer you had it open? You're not a fan of air conditioning?
No, I mean, it's just that I like fresh air. So when it was, springtime, I'd leave the door open. But I did have a little gate out there for my baby, and I had my baby on the porch. They thought that was odd, too.
What do you mean, your baby?
My little person was out there on the porch.
Like your literal
son.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm saying your baby. It could be your dog. I don't know.
We call our dogs our babies.
Oh, yeah. No, this was an actual baby.
This is an actual human
baby. Baby. Okay.
But I did. My neighbor was handicapped, and he would sit on the porch right next door to us. And he was watching, he would say, Elaine, because by this time now we've been living there. We lived there for 8 years. By this time I had a second child, and my second child, when I had the door open, heard the ice cream truck and went and got my pocketbook and walked out to the ice cream truck with my pocketbook. And so, it was amazing going from country living to city living.
Okay.
And just,
Right.
Just matriculating with everybody. It was an experience.
So that's what they're doing in Trenton.
Yes.
Like that's their Trenton history, but they also record a show in Trenton.
That I know, too.
On Newport City's platform.
Newport City.
We do.
With Frank Sasso.
Yes, we do.
I just want to unpack this for a second.
Sure. Yeah. Go ahead.
You have a show called Lifting the Veil.
Yes.
It talks about the truth and kind of uncovers and unveils, if you will, the truth about African-American history.
Yes.
Misconceptions, lies, untruth, skewed facts, right? What needs to get straightened out of African-American history?
Frank's asking that as the, the guy who just crawled out of a hole.
No, but seriously,
who am I?
Are you saying that the history that we learned in school
isn't true?
It's not real. It's not right.
What little there
George
was.
George Washington didn't figure out how to cross the Delaware on his own.
Not without the Marbleheaders.
Were his teeth really from slaves? I don't think they were.
Yes,
I read up on this because here's why I read up on it. It sounded like that could be a real thing.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking if someone was that, like, they're slaves and I'm here, I can't see them ever wanting to take their teeth and putting in their mouth. I could see, and I did look it up, I could see a dentist appropriating teeth for profit for both people, maybe the slaves or the freed black people, freed white people who needed money, selling their teeth to a dentist and then the dentist passing it along to his client. That's what I've read.
Who knows if...
I mean, a lot of it was, we don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, don't know because there's a lot that we don't know associated with George Washington. But what we do know is that he was a slave master to close to 300 enslaved people.
Right.
And that he inherited a lot of his wife's... Actually, his wife was the one with the cash.
Okay.
So she was the one that pretty much was bringing the slaves to the plantation. So, he inherited her property, slaves, et cetera, et cetera.
As what happens when you get married. Yeah. As a woman, you lose all your...
Yeah, it becomes... Yeah, and let me tell you, the father of our country. These were flawed individuals. And to Frank's point about lifting the veil, what do we have to lift the veil? Okay, well, let's lift the veil on George for a minute. All right?
I call him Boy George.
Boy George. There's two enslaved people in particular that I'm thinking of.
Okay.
But the one that the female, Ona Judge, was her name. He would bring his enslaved people to Philadelphia. At that time, Pennsylvania had a law that if you were an enslaved person, but if you were in residence for 6 months or beyond, you would be eligible to be freed. Now, what he would do is he would rotate the enslaved people so they were never there for that time period, so they would never be eligible for freedom, to apply for the freedom, to try to manumit themselves. So he was constantly doing this whenever he come to Philadelphia. Ona Judge was one of his was Martha's most quote-unquote prized enslaved individuals. This woman, I guess she was her personal
her
maid.
Her lady's maid.
Her lady's maid.
Right, okay.
And Ona wanted to be free. She, I mean, come on, who wants to be
I was
going to
say, and who doesn't?
So Ona Judge, she...
How dare she?
How dare she want to be free? So she pretty much just walked away one night. She found an opportunity to walk away, and that's what she did. She ended up in New England. I don't know exactly where, but I know that it was... She ended up trying to live her life as a free woman, and they were constantly pursuing her because they could not understand why she'd want to be free. They said, we treated her so well. They just could not get it in their head that this woman would want to be a free woman.
So you have these people who have a skewed vision of other people. And in their dumbness, ignorance, stupidity, they really believe that they can't understand how someone would want to be free because they have such a good life with us. I'm trying to understand. I think I can almost understand, like, oh, but we're so nice. I don't understand. Why do you want to leave? Because you can't understand that I would want to
be free.
I don't know.
Well, first of all, you have to understand these people, it's called agency. These people wanted to have agency, which means they wanted to be, the captain of their own lives. They wanted to be able to control their own lives. They wanted
the enslaved
to be,
people.
Yes, they wanted to be, having my, you know. I want to be, I want to run my life and live my life the way I want to do this, not at the tune of a white person that who actually could sell me. At the drop of...
And then it's not so nice where I am.
You know, because, you know.
When you
look at it that way, but let's look a little deeper into this thinking. You have to believe that that person, that enslaved person, is inherently not as good as you are.
Right. Inferior.
Is inferior.
Gotcha.
You have to believe in your heart of hearts that this person simply does not have the capacity to feel or desire, want, believe the same thing that I do as a white person.
Correct.
So why should she want, why would she want, this black woman, she's a black woman.
Gotcha.
She doesn't have the capacity. So that's where you have to start, number one.
Right.
But many of them, they couldn't go beyond that because they were taught to believe one thing. They were taught to think in one way about African Americans. You know, all of our founding fathers were, had enslaved people. How many signers of the Declaration has that?
Would it be almost 100%?
Almost. Yeah. And they simply did not believe that people of African descent were equal in any way, shape, or form. That we were not even able to assimilate into white society. It was unthinkable for that, for them to even imagine black people assimilating into white society.
And is it just based on, like, I don't know if you have the answer to this, but like, where did that come from? Is it just from the fact that they were captured and kidnapped, or is it just from the fact that their skin color, they look different, their hair's different, features are different, or is it a combination of the two?
It's a combination.
I would say it's
both.
A combination. Yeah.
Yes, I would say because actually, when you think of them capturing and kidnapping people. Some of these people were African queens and kings.
So leaders. Not like they were just, leaders.
Yeah,
right.
You're just going kidnapping a bunch of random people. You have stripped them of
with
who they
cultured societies. Yeah. And, you know, they were trading and, you know, had, you know, they were extremely sophisticated, many of them.
Yeah, this podcast will mess you up. Because I'm like, now you're going to ruin George Washington for me, and you're ruining 4th of July for me. So, like, right before the 4th of July, we're going upstate, me and Christine.
That's right.
And we were having a 4th of July celebration.
Right.
And right before we leave, I'm going to go to a session with Bev and Lady Elaine.
Yes.
And they start talking about the 4th of July and how evil it is and all this other stuff. And I'm like, hey, you got to ruin the 4th of July. And so Beverly says to me, oh, no. Go and still light your fireworks. And stuff. I'm like, I can't light them now and enjoy it.
Yeah.
Now I feel a little guilty.
No, you don't have to feel guilty. You just need to understand.
Right.
We don't want you to feel guilty.
No.
Sheesh.
You go do you, because for us, it's a whole different playing field. You know, our freedom does not match up with your freedom. So, you know, you...
No, I get that. But you guys are like the film blurs of American African-American history.
Yes.
I don't feel guilty. I feel sad, and I feel, because I'm like, I'm not responsible. Maybe my culture is or whatever, but I don't feel guilty. I feel like, oh, that's terribly sad. So what can we do to be different?
Right.
You know, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You want to do better. Mm-hmm. You want to learn. Mm-hmm. I know, which is, you know, that's most of the battle. It's, you know, people that don't want this information to be out there, the people that have prevented it from being out there for years and years and years and years, going back to people that, you know, edited and censored information in school books.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the thing is, you want to be part of the solution,
not
part of the problem.
Exactly.
And so, but, you know, it's hard for Beverly and I, because not only are we exposing parts of history that have been untold, they're there. It's just that we're starting to unearth more. But now for us, we are connected to the white family names that were actual slave owners for this region.
Mm-hmm.
And we think about, oh my goodness, for us, it's a bittersweet, because if you were your family was my slave owner, and here we are going to school with some of the people, it's hard on us, and it's hard on the people who were the enslavers as well.
So you have that experience, both of you, that you have been
unbeknownst, you know, this information has only become available to, I mean, this is what we've researched and found out. I mean, when I was going to school, I went to school with kids with the last name of Hoagland, of Blackwell, of, you know, those are all names of some of the white founding families in the region.
In this area?
In the Pennington,
really?
In the Hopewell Valley area.
Okay.
If people of a certain means all had enslaved people in this region.
In this region?
In this region.
So what about Mills and Buck?
I never knew that.
What about Mills and Buck?
Well, Mills is my husband's name, and he came from the Savannah, Georgia area. So I don't know.
All right. What was your maiden name?
Smith. And yes. So Smith, there were.
So that's a white name.
That was a white name, and there was a plantation, and the slave master was named
Wes Smith. Yeah.
And it was in Ewing. So I haven't been able to trace it all the way back to this particular man. I mean, it
and
takes
mine was Hunt.
A huge amount of time.
Well, what about
my
that?
Maiden
Hunt?
Name was Hunt.
Same thing.
And so you have the Hunt farm, not just one. You have several families.
The Hunt house.
Hunt farms. Yep, and the Hunt house. And so, I mean, we're like, oh my goodness.
How about the runaway notices?
And yeah, the runaway notices, the man's name is John Hunt. And the person that ran away was Peter Waldron. Well, Peter Waldron, that's also my family name, the Waldron. And so.
Well, at least Hunt is a little bit more, I would think, more doable than Smith. Where do you start with that?
Right.
Well, you have to go, you know, it was a Smith that was in the Ewing Township region.
No, but Beverly, I'm just saying the name Smith is such a crazy popular name.
Yeah.
How do you really know if what you're looking at is legit?
Because you have to go back into, as far back into the records that you can. You have to go into his will and see if there was any enslaved people that he left.
Mm-hmm.
to his family members.
Here's the thing. Smith is like looking for a needle in a haystack.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But keep in mind now, Beverly's Frost Blackwell, mm-hmm. I found his name mm-hmm. on the manumission papers that mm-hmm. they have. And the manumission means you were freed, finally. And so Frost Blackwell was on one of the manumission papers, and we connected him to Andrew Blackwell, who is from this area, from Hopewell Township. Mm-hmm. And but we found him on freedom papers, on manumission papers.
That were filed with the court.
Mm-hmm. So for black people, I don't know if you saw 60 Minutes last night, but they did have a family that is from Virginia, and the black family bought a home and did not know that it was the plantation that their family was enslaved on. And so I'm looking at the names of the people from this 60 Minutes document, and one of the ladies' name is Sonia Womack. And mm-hmm. I'm thinking,
there you go.
That's my family name too, the Womack family name, and it's in the same area where my family came from Pennsylvania County, Virginia. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you look at all of this, and when you're looking and you find the slave owner, and he has a list of his possessions, and it just says Negro boy, Negro girl, or their age, or whatever, you still have to dig. Black people, we have to dig deeper. Mm. Like, you could go now and say, oh, let me, you know, go on Ancestry, and you can go back probably to the beginning of your family lineage. Everybody can't, but most white people can. For black people, you hit that roadblock. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes Beverly so different than most, because she's gone back 5 generations.
Wow. That's because the advantage, if there is an advantage to that whole enslaved story for my family, is that this Blackwell was enslaved in New Jersey, in Hopewell Township, where his enslaver kept scrupulous notes, and he kept his will. Mm-hmm. He mentioned him by name.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So for the majority of African Americans, they have no clues like that. You just don't know.
I actually knew that because we were watching Finding Your Roots.
And I
remember him saying that. It's like, this mm-hmm. is so wild that you can actually trace it because there's a name attached.
There was a name.
But here's something I didn't know. I didn't know there were slaves up in New Jersey.
Oh, girl, please.
So I didn't. So this is something that I didn't know.
Yeah, that's why we know this stuff. Yeah, that's why we need you guys.
Yeah.
Well, that's why we wrote the book, If These Stones Could Talk, because a lot of the information is buried with the enslaved people.
Yeah, because in my head, you know, everybody south of the Mason-Dixon line, that was it.
No. Let me tell you how bad New Jersey was. New Jersey was the last northern state to abolish slavery.
What?
Meaning Pennsylvania, New York,
Rhode Island.
They had all, you know, yes.
Oh, I just got the chills.
New York was before Jersey?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yes. Jersey didn't want to give up their peeps.
Now, you're talking
about... Speaking about peeps, we may have to stop for 1 minute. Speaking about peeps, we're just going to take a break real quick. We'll be right back. All right, podcast, here we are back. Talking about New Jersey being the last state to abolish slavery.
The last northern state to abolish slavery.
The last northern state.
In 1804. So this is what happened. So New Jersey's situated between New York, Philadelphia, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Accessible for many things.
Right.
Now, but politically, New Jersey was the most southern sympathizing state in the north. I mean, we were Southern sympathizers for a very, very long time.
Wow.
So finally, legislatively, they passed this gradual law that said, if you have an enslaved child born July 4th, 1804, you will have to work as, quote unquote, an apprentice for a male till the age of 25. And for a female, the age of 21. So that means if I'm an enslaved woman, I have this baby, I can only hope for my child to be free after 25 for a male, 21, 20. Mm-hmm. And which also means that this slave master who was born to could take my child and lend them out to someone else to work. So that's where the apprentice part comes in. Mm-hmm. Because realistically, they were not obligated financially to keep them, you know. And so there's all kinds of shenanigans that went on, and they set up this kind of fund where they can apply for money. You know, it's all in the history, but I won't go into that. But that was why it was called the Gradual Abolition Act. Mm-hmm. That was New Jersey.
Wow. So you hear that, New Jersey?
Yeah. Get your act together.
I'm from New York.
Yes, thank God.
And you know, to call somebody an apprentice, you know, it's just like my family, they were sharecroppers. So now slavery is over, but now you're a sharecropper. And it's like,
You're mm-hmm. never financially out of the bondage.
What's a sharecropper?
Why don't you explain that?
Well, so the sharecroppers would work for sometimes the enslaved people, mm-hmm. the enslaver, and the enslaved people would stay on after, you know, slavery's
over. Emancipation.
So now, you know, they would stay on with that. Yeah, because where were you going to go? That's right. I asked my great-grandmother, I said, Grammy, did you leave? And she said, where were we going to go?
Right.
All they knew was where they lived and who they were enslaved by.
So they couldn't get paid now at this point?
Well, they're supposed to. So you're supposed to share the crops with the person.
Right.
And the person they were enslaved, well, the person they were sharecropping with was the Hayes family from Pennsylvania County in Danville, Virginia. And at the end of the season, they were supposed to share the money.
Mm-hmm.
Probably they had some kind of 50-50 arrangement.
No, it was never 50-50.
And
never.
I was going to say, they mm-mm. probably thought it was.
No.
So they did all the work and, you know, and raised
like 95-5.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. then at the end of the season, the person would say, well, you know, we really didn't make that much money, and so I only have this amount to give you or whatever. Right. And so they got cheated again.
So the sharecropping, that's the way they would do it, right, is that they were right. there was all kinds of expenses that were attached to it.
Right,
there was your seed. You also, we had to charge you for, you know, whatever your groceries were. So mm-hmm. the sharecroppers always ended up owing.
Mm-hmm. So still enslaved in some manner.
Yes.
Right, mm-hmm. right. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, because it kind of still ekes into now today.
It mm-hmm. goes all the way till today. Mm-hmm. And you never really could own property. So finally, when people could own property, I'm thankful that my great-grandparents had the sense to buy their home in Hopewell.
Mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. otherwise, I know I wouldn't be there. The homes in Hopewell are so expensive. You know, starting the lowest on my street was like almost $500,000
for
a home, you know, mm-hmm. that has maybe two bedrooms.
So you mentioned your great-grandmother. That must have been amazing to have known her and the experiences of her life.
Yes.
What about your grandmother? Any experiences that you've had with her that you'd like to share?
I grew up with my grandmother on Columbia Avenue. And my great-grandmother and great-grandfather lived on the other side of the street, about four houses up. So my whole family kind of lived right there together. And so with my grandmother, I went to work with her as a young child. And she worked locally. She worked at a home in Princeton. And I want to say it was Senator Katzenbach's grandmother. Might have been his mother, but it might have been his grandmother.
It was definitely that family.
Yeah, it was mm-hmm. definitely that family. They lived in Princeton right near the Peacock Inn, which kind of giving them a little shout out because it's still there.
Yes, I know exactly mm-hmm. where it is.
Mm-hmm. And so my grandmother, just like in the movie The Help, was taking care of the elderly lady. She was upstairs in her bedroom, which was huge. It had a desk, and it also had two or three chairs and a table where she would eat. But I noticed that she was eating by herself, and I did not know that we were relegated to eat downstairs in the kitchen. There was a little table with two chairs, and it had a red top to the table, and kind of like the, you know, the classic kitchen of that day. And my grandmother made the lunch. I can still see some of the lunch. She always had, in the summertime, we always had like sliced tomatoes and cucumbers, and she had made a sandwich. And so the house had two stairwells, and you could go to the left and go up to the ladies' bedroom, or you could go to the right and go up to the ladies' bedroom. So my grandmother set our little lunch table. And but I had seen her give the lady her lunch. I went upstairs with her, and I was helping. We had, you know, lemonade and all, and we gave her her lunch, and she was sitting there.
She really nestles into a story, doesn't she?
No, it's really creating this great picture. I'm like drawn in. I'm like, still see I'm there.
Yeah, I can still see it. And the lady was like, you know, for me, it was like a grandmother type, you know. She was actually dressed, you know, how the grandmothers of that day, she was dressed. I thought she was going somewhere. She was so dressed up. So we're back downstairs, and I'm supposed to be eating my lunch at this little table. And I realized that the lady upstairs was eating by herself.
Right.
So I picked up my plate, and I went to the stairwell on the right, and my grandmother was doing something and didn't see me get up and take my plate and go upstairs. And she, I laugh at my grandmother because I would surprise her. I really did not swim with the rest of the fish. I just didn't. And she came upstairs looking for me, I guess, because all of a sudden now I'm not sitting at the table and my plate is gone. She's probably wondering, where is this girl? And she comes upstairs, and there I am sitting at the table with the white lady.
Oh, my
Girl,
God.
Girl, what made you think you could go up there and sit with that white woman?
Yeah, really.
First off, I didn't know she was a white lady.
Okay. What are you so talking about? Wait a second.
Let's get this straight.
Wait a second. You're telling me you've never seen this woman before?
No, I saw her before.
How did you not know she was white?
I didn't care.
She didn't recognize the difference.
That's not what she said.
I did not know.
She didn't care she was white.
I didn't even know. I didn't even, like, why would I know? I might as well have been blind.
But in all innocence, you would notice that her skin is lighter. Oh. You would have noticed just to notice.
Yeah, so?
You didn't understand the caste system, you're saying.
Right.
You didn't understand. Right. You didn't understand that your little black butt should not have been up in there.
Right. No, nobody said you got to eat down here. My grandmother didn't tell me these kind of things. She just kind of knew that this is the way life was, and that's why she made my plate and her plate.
It didn't even occur to her to tell you.
No. I mean, what was she going to tell me? First, she'd have to start out with, and I'm not black, okay? I'm tantalizingly brown. So let's get this straight, okay?
And so, tantalizingly.
So she would have had to explain
that. Is that your pronoun?
She would have had to explain that. And then she would have had to explain. And so by the time you get done explaining all this, keep in mind, my grandmother's working, you know? Mm-hmm. And so now I'm upstairs and I'm eating. And the lady, my grandmother came up and looked at me like she had seen some kind of alien. And I turned around to look to see who she was looking at. Because she was...
She certainly wasn't looking at you.
Yeah, I was wondering.
Right.
I didn't do anything. And so the lady looked at her and said... And the lady's name was Mrs. Katzenbach, by the way, so I'll call her Mrs. Katzenbach, looked at Hester, my grandmother.
Queen
Hester, and said, oh, no, she's okay. And so I stayed there and ate my lunch with her. And then after lunch, the lady brought out a checkerboard and taught me how to play checkers.
Oh, Miss Katzenbach brought
it out. Mrs. Katzenbach brought out it. She was happy to have company.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, thank God you brought your tantalizingly brown self up there. That's good.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Beverly, do you go by that same moniker, tantalizingly brown?
No, I'm just black.
You're just black. We can't all be tantalizingly brown.
Oh, Lord.
I'm tantalizingly peach.
Peach? I don't know.
Olive? I don't know.
They're in season now.
Thank you, Lady Elaine.
Do you have any similar stories from when you remember?
Oh. You know, before I was old enough to go to school, I can remember going to work with my mother. Mm-hmm. And a similar situation. And I would would be with, you know, she would make lunch for the lady of the house, and we would sit in a separate place and eat. I never ventured off to, you know, eat with the lady of the house. You know, I guess I knew from a very young age that, you know, I was to stay with my mm-hmm. mother. I can only describe growing up in Pennington as pretty much similar to a southern town, mm-hmm. Only in the north, the only difference being in the north, because many of the women were well-to-do or, you know, or aspired to be well-to-do, and they stayed home. They were stay-at-home women. They did not work, and so they had help to come in, and the women that lived on my block, because in Pennington on South Main Street, that was the quote-unquote black section, or if it was a certain time period, quote-unquote colored section, mm-hmm. and each of the ladies would have someone that they would work for, either most of the time was either in Pennington or Princeton. They didn't really venture too further away from either Pennington or Princeton. So that's the way it was. And I can recall, you know, my mother working for a few families. And it's interesting that even though it was that caste system, mm-hmm. my mother became very good friends with one of those women. They really became very good friends. And it was almost like it transcended, you're my, you know, mm-hmm. you're my cleaning lady. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting to watch. And as I grew up and became a mother, and I remember this woman, by this time she was elderly, and I remember she would always call and try to keep up with me. By that time, my mother had passed away. And when my mother passed away, this woman was shattered.
Shattered
beyond belief. I've never seen anyone cry like that, because they really had become good friends.
Your mother was young.
My mother was very young when she died. My mother was only 40 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very young.
So the situation in Pennington, and I can recall my Aunt Winnie working for this one woman who, for some reason, would like to talk to her about all of her social activities as if it mattered, you know, to my. And she'd talk about, you know, being in the social register and doing this and doing that. And when her daughters were of college age, and she said, well, what do you mean Karen's going to college? And she was like, I just assumed that your daughters would start working for my daughters. So it was the same mentality mm-hmm. that many of them had, is mm-hmm. that, you know, the beat goes on, you
right.
know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, your daughter would aspire or even be, you know, going to college kind of thing. You know, oh, I thought she would just want to be a cleaning lady for yeah. my daughter.
Wow.
Well, Beverly, I went talking about college. Is this part of what your college career was about?
No. Okay. When I got out of high school, my mother had just passed away. I had applied to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts.
Oh, really?
In Manhattan.
Wow.
And I was accepted.
Ooh.
Oh, really?
This is a whole nother of tangent.
Did you go?
I did, but I wasn't able to go until the following year because my mother had passed away, and she left a baby. It was my brother and I are 18 years apart. And it was a huge tragedy that happened in our family. And
yes.
I just couldn't get up and go to New York and leave my dad. My mm-hmm. And when I think back on it now, my dad was a widower at 45 years old.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so my brother was being raised by my mom's sister. And so I just wanted to be close to the family for a year. And mm-hmm. so I waited a year, and then I went the following year. But I did go to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts.
Wow.
And then I guess my father got tired of supporting me, as he said.
Well, you were a struggling actor.
Yeah, that kind of thing. And he said, you know what, you're going to have to get a job. I can't do this. Mm-hmm. I can't, you know.
Yeah.
You're way too expensive. I can't do this.
Did you live in New York?
I did. I lived in Manhattan. I lived on East 88th Street between York and East End.
Wow. Yeah. Did you love it?
For me at that time, it worked.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It worked very well.
Wow.
Yeah, and so, you know, I've done different things in my life. I came back, and so after, so during that phase while I was in New York, I got very involved with some Black Muslims.
Okay.
Yeah. And I came back and looking very different than when I went to New York. And I would go, I would come back and forth on weekends, but, you know, I came from a very conservative Black family. My father and my grandfather were very conservative. And so when I came back with, this is before braids were even popular.
So what year are we talking about?
69
okay.
And 70.
All okay. right.
Mm-hmm. Braids weren't popular then?
They were just coming into vogue, but not every, it hadn't really reached the Pennington.
I think afros were kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah, afros, yeah, but not the cornrows. Right. And, okay. and I took it a step further with a ring in my nose.
Oh, great.
And no underwear.
All right. Okay.
Oh, all right.
Your underwear on now, I hope.
No, don't answer that.
So, anyway.
It now she has on a thong.
All right. Thank you, Lady Elaine.
You know, get that image out of your head.
Oh, don't mind goodness. You, I'm much, young, I'm much
you
younger.
Never, you never expect 20... coming this coming from Lady Elaine. That, she's very unassuming.
Yeah, yeah. That's the trick there.
So take my, you know, I'm 20 years old. And so I come to, you know, and my father was just absolutely... He was so mad, he couldn't even speak. And he said to me, what are you doing? You look, he said, you look awful. I've never seen you look worse. He said, look at your hair. Look at you. And what have you done? You put something in your nose. What is going on with you? You've lost your mind. He thought, I don't know. I guess he wanted to have me committed. He thought I had really had some kind of mental breakdown.
So he looked at you like Hester would look at me.
Yes!
Like
there was he gave
an
me,
alien.
There's that alien there.
Yeah. I'm thinking I might have sided with your dad.
gave me the Queen Hester look. Yeah. So, I mean, I was back then really... looking deeper into who am I as an African-American person? How do I fit into this picture? And who are these people here in Harlem up here? Who are these people that have these different beliefs? And what are they trying to tell me about my African background that I never heard about before? Mm-hmm. How come I'm hearing this information? So it kind of propelled me to think a little expansively about coming as a little colored girl from Pennington, New Jersey to wait a minute. How come we have Black people I see on the bus that speak French? How come I see Black people that speak Spanish, but they're clearly Black? I see this. How do we all fit into this African diaspora? How did this happen? And so these Muslims, even though they were, you know, they were on the radical side, they would explain. They'd explain it.
Hey, hold on to that, Bev. We're going to take a quick break. We are back.
So living in New York and going into meeting people that were involved with the Black Muslim movement opened up a different way for me to think about things, even though I didn't embrace everything that they believed. And so it was a way that I started to look at things a little differently and really appreciate my African-American history and what we contributed to this country, which was never explained before.
Right.
Never, ever, ever. So I really value my time that I lived in New York. And I think it really helped me open my eyes from a little color girl to what's really out there.
At any moment when you were in New York, did you have the opportunity to play checkers with a white lady? I'm going to take that as a no. You want to follow up with your question real quick?
Well, I'm going to ask both of you ladies individually. Since you have a different perspective on Trenton because you used to come here years ago and you don't really live here now and your experience is different, I'm going to ask the same question. In your imaginings of Trenton, what would your dream Trenton look like?
I can remember walking from my grandmother's beauty salon on Montgomery Place in West Trenton, all the way to the movie theaters and walking past the brownstones and just loving every minute of it. I felt like I was transported into another world. Trenton, in my day, when I was visiting my grandma, 60s, early 60s, late 50s, very, very early 70s, Trenton was magical. Anything you wanted, you could come to Trenton and get it.
Mm.
It was just electric. It was beautiful. It was a blend of people. I would love to see that Trenton again.
Mm-hmm.
Downtown was the place to go.
Downtown was the place. Anything. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was 15 years old, I tried to buy some fake eyelashes. I wanted some.
I think you still can get them downtown.
Yeah, but not the that's kind of, when I shut my eyes, I can still see this beautiful, beautiful shop with these gorgeous makeup and perfume and different, everything was gorgeous. I remember the Savoy restaurant. We would sit in there and we would have this chicken salad on rye toast. I can remember everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I remember coming down on the bus to Trenton, and then we would go shopping and we'd eat lunch at like Kresge's or somewhere. And then I'd come down on Broad Street and I'd go to Ira Blackman's store. Mm-hmm. And he was this real progressive black man that dressed with African clothing.
I remember Ira.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He always had like a dashiki. So I got a dashiki. Keep in mind, I'm a teenager and I'm still going to Hopewell. Valley Central High School.
Been interesting.
So I was kind of mixed up in high school too because the Black Panthers were, you know, mm-hmm. they were prevalent. But also, you know, the mamas and the papas, those are my peeps too. So I, you know, had to do like a little flower child thing or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I could come down to Trenton and I could get some African-inspired clothing and earrings. And, you know, we would buy our... incense, you always had incense burning and the music, you know, because we'd come down to the Ace record shop here.
Oh my God.
And we'd get our music.
You could get the music.
Yeah, because we didn't have all these things that we have now with our iPhones or whatever.
No.
And I remember coming down and
food.
Going to Carmen Armenti's, going there and eating Italian food. I mean, it was just. Who it was. And then all of a sudden it kind of changed. And it's like I really would like to see some kind of revitalization.
Oh, it could come back.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I see that hotel that's sitting there empty and I think, oh, that could be housing for so many people. People need a place to live. They really do.
If you want downtown to be vital, you need to have people living here.
Right. Right. Exactly. Right? Exactly. Right? Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you have to have a school system that people believe in, that works well.
Right. Mm-hmm. You paint such beautiful pictures. Like, I'm a very visual person, especially inside my own head. Mm-hmm. So when you say words and things, you're creating this beautiful movie in my head.
Yes.
And I almost feel like Trenton has all the raw ingredients because I've never felt afraid here.
Mm-hmm.
I've never felt like, oh, this is a black community or this is the Latino. I feel very free walking wherever I walk.
Monica.
I mean, and I just feel that's the kind of vibe we have in this town. It's very, you know, you go to Mill Hill Saloon and you're going to see every shape, color and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You can go any of these places and never feel like I don't belong. It's a very embracing kind of city. Mm-hmm. And
Candlelight Lounge alone is a melting
that
pot.
That to me is a portal into like
another
a little
realm.
Piece of heaven.
Right.
Because
yeah.
you go in there and everybody's there to hear the jazz.
Yes.
But then
and the food.
You go and then you get the food and then you get the conversation and then who's outside having a cigar. And it's just this amazing place.
It is.
Sure.
Yeah. It is.
Absolutely.
So,
and it was then and it can be again.
It has all the underpinnings.
Yes. Yes.
She will walk down the street at 10 o'clock at night, much to my chagrin, walk down the street 10 o'clock at night and walk through an army of black guys.
Yeah, well.
Right? And she'll walk right through the middle of them and go, good evening, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
And they all like, you know, they all like kind of like they walk away and like they have the doubt, but they bow
they
their heads.
They say hello and they say
They do say, they're very respectful, right?
Yes, yeah, I've never had an issue.
Why wouldn't they be?
Because most white people would think, oh, you're walking through a crowd of black guys by yourself.
Of course they'd be terrified.
Well, that's why I'm saying it.
Yeah. Well, and I also want to give respect. I'm not going to make any assumptions on what you guys are doing here. I'm just going to assume you're all gentlemen.
Yeah.
So I address you as such.
Absolutely.
And I believe they have your back.
And I was thinking about after the rebellions, the Trenton area had the guardian angels. And I love the guardian angels because you could feel comfortable just walking.
I love them. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Just
love
walking
them.
At any time of the night. I'd go down to there was a store on Spring Street, and I'd walk down there with my kids. But they were young, so I make them put their little karate outfits on because they were my protectors. And they had their little Chinese stars and all, just in case somebody tried to mess with mom.
Ninja stars.
I call them Chinese stars.
Don't call them Chinese stars. What are you, a racist?
What the heck?
Oh, come on.
We're going to lift the veil on Chinese American history in a minute.
Oh. Well, okay.
You're Beverly hiding her face.
No, I have my little stars. Oh, come on, people. And so, anyway, I just remembered the guardian angels just like being on kind of almost every corner.
Yeah.
That was which nice. That was, I liked that.
Yeah,
that
was New York too. They were very big.
Yeah. They were in the subways. Yep.
Remember them?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Beverly, Elaine, would you like to hang around for a little something we call plugs?
Yeah. Our podcast is...
No. Yes or no? Yes or no?
Yes! She's like ready to go.
Here we go.
Yes.
Tracking Waves Plugs. Hey, Podcastia, let's see what this guest has to plug.
Trenton Waves, TrentonWaves.com. Visit us on all social media platforms, including but not limited to Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and now TikTok.
I just went on Twitter this morning.
You went on Twitter. Oh, that's right. Christina is now on Twitter. Podcastia, lock the doors, phone the neighbors. You're on alert. Christina is now on Twitter under Sass. I think it's at Sassa Christina.
Yes.
Correct? Is that all right?
Yes.
Just coming from Dallas, you actually took a class about TikTok for podcasting, correct?
Mm-hmm.
You found it wildly informative?
It was. There's a lot of little secrets and ins and outs that I would never have figured out.
We're going to be implementing that soon on New Pod City. What do you got to plug?
Well, of course, First Friday's coming up. We just finished the initiative downtown to come on Saturdays and support, but I don't think it should end. I think... Even though officially it's ended, I think we should keep doing that. So keep coming downtown on Saturdays and support local businesses so that they can stay open on the weekends and we as residents can enjoy everything that's downtown. There's lots of stuff going around in the city happening at the Trenton Public Library. Please check them out. Ellerslie Museum, check that out. Trent House has stuff going on. Artworks has stuff. There's just so many things to name, I would suggest you just go on their websites or go on social media and check everything out. There's something going on every weekend. So if you have nothing to do, come to Trenton. There's plenty to do here.
Right. And real quick, Beverly and Elaine, would you guys be interested in Twister with the mayor?
Well, let me say something.
I just want to know if you guys would be interested in a Twister competition with Mayor Reed Gussiora.
I think Elaine would be very good at that.
What about you? Not you, Bev?
You know what?
What's the matter?
I've got this knee thing. And so
I'll put some cream on it and get your socks on and play Twister with the mayor.
Yeah, okay. If I can put some cream on, I'd be twisting.
We can even make it like a fundraising or a charity event.
I think that's eventually what we're going to have to do because I don't think anybody's biting on this event.
You don't know. People are staying quiet because they're waiting to see what's going on.
Elaine, you want to play Twister? Do you remember that game?
Yes.
How old are you?
I'm 68. I'll be 69.
You're 68 years old.
Oh, wow. All right. What day in December?
December 6th.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And you're March 7th.
I am.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. 6 and 7. Yeah. Go together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Twister with the mayor.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's do it. Okay, guys. How can people find you? How can people know you? How can people see you? How can they go online to experience all things Beverly and Elaine? What's the matter? What happened?
We're on
the computer.
You can hear us on our podcast that drops every Tuesday. Mm-hmm. It's called Lifting the Veil under New Pod City.
That's right. You can also go to Friday True Heart Consultants if you need some more information. We have all our information there on our website.
Yep.
One thing I do want to tell you, our second documentary, part two of The Price of Silence, just aired last Thursday night on New Jersey PBS. So if you want to see part one and part two, The Price of Silence.
And they can go online and find that.
You can go online.
Yes.
And you can find that. And another thing I'd like to let you know is we are having a weekend journey through history at our Stoutsburg Sauerland African American Museum in Skillman, New Jersey on Hollow Road. Beverly and I are the co-founders of this wonderful museum.
Mm-hmm.
Come out and see us on October 8th and the 9th. And see if we have wonderful things that we would like to show you. There'll be tours and just some good food and mm-hmm. just come and join us.
Yes.
And we also have our book, which is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. We have If These Stones Could Talk by Beverly Mills and Elaine Buck.
That'll give you a historical perspective of the African-American experience in this region.
Well, that just about does it for another episode of Trenton Waves.
Sasso's out.
You've been listening to the Trenton Waves podcast. Visit us online at trentonwaves.com.